Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Hello to you, the listener. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Gail Seiler, your host for today. Coming up on the show, we have a preview of ISU football done by Colin Bursack, one of KHOI's summer interns from the Greeley School of Journalism. And because it's the fourth Friday of the month, Ames Progressive Alliance will be here, and they will be joined by a guest from Primary Healthcare to let us know about the services that they offer. And because it's Friday, we have Dennis Hart with the news. So, Dennis, talk to us.
Thank you, Gail, and hello, everybody. Let's start by going back, way back, to Saturday's Ames Tribune, which reported that the city was still drying out from those tremendous thunderstorms that pounded us a week ago Thursday. Iowa State University's facilities planning and management called it a top 15 historic flood event. Water ended up inside some ISU buildings, and minor flooding took place at Vinker Golf Course, the Disc Golf Course, and several other areas near or on campus. In Ames, numerous streets were flooded, and so was Brookside Park and part of the Hunziker Youth Sports Complex. Saturday's Trib also reported that the Story County Board of Supervisors awarded the county animal shelter's renovation project to the Ames-based Harold Pike Construction Company. The supervisors unanimously approved the base amount of the project, $380,000, along with two alternates, $13,500 to replace two of the building's furnaces and $9,000 for the addition of acoustic panels. The cost of the project could change later. Sunday's Trib had word that the Ames City Council has given the police department the green light to buy body cameras for its patrol officers. The price for the 60 cameras, warranties, and other expenses will be nearly $142,000. The department hopes to receive the cameras within the next couple of months and start training with them. Sunday's Trib also reported on the first day of the Ames Grand Prix, which took place Saturday. Bicyclists raced around Main Street and several other streets, and Sunday's part of the race took place at the Iowa State University Research Park. Sunday's Trib also had word that Iowa State University will host a national center of excellence devoted to understanding the mechanisms that govern genetic traits in swine. And there was word on Sunday that Iowa State students will soon be able to produce ice cream and cheese right on campus, thanks to a new micro-creamery operation set to start at the university this fall. The micro-creamery will be in the Food Sciences Building. Among the first things that will be produced, the university's signature ice cream flavor. It's called, as you may know, Sice Cream, and it features peanut butter ice cream, chocolate-covered rice crisps, and fudge swirls. And I want some. The Trib does not publish on Mondays, but Tuesday's edition had word that Ames School District Superintendent Tim Taylor and Associate Superintendent Mandy Ross attended their final school board meetings on Monday night. Taylor is retiring after 26 years in the district, while Ross will soon take over as the new superintendent in the Webster City School District. Ames School Board President Elisa Franzen and other board members praised Taylor. Franzen said she appreciated the work he's done and thanked him for his service to the district. Tuesday's Tribune also reported that Iowa Republicans have picked a former member of the Ames City Council as their nominee for state treasurer. 40-year-old Jeremy Davis was elected to the council in 2009 and served for 4 years. He also worked in Republican Congressman Steve King's office, and he's the treasurer of Story County's Republican Party. He also works for the National Pork Producers Council. Davis will face longtime incumbent Michael Fitzgerald, a Democrat, in the November general election. Fitzgerald was first elected in 1982. He is the longest-serving state treasurer in the United States, and he's also the brother of Story County Sheriff Paul Fitzgerald. There was more in Tuesday's Trib, including word that an Ames couple was arrested after authorities said they found a malnourished dog when they went to evict the couple from the mobile home where they were living. Celia Kanai Davis and Darius Graves, both 26 years old, were charged with animal neglect. Court documents reveal that when authorities went to their residence at the Hickory Grove Court Mobile Home Park, they found a female husky in a wire cage. The animal had no food or water and weighed only 23 pounds, half of what a typical dog of her size usually weighs. Tuesday's Trib also had a story warning all of us that more heavy rain was in the forecast for Ames and surrounding areas this week, and we saw that it came. In addition to creating worries about more possible flooding, that forecast was also bad news for some farmers dealing with fields that flooded during last week's thunder boomers. Now there's still time for some farmers to replant their soybean crops if they have to, but the window to replant corn, it's closed. Also Tuesday, the Trib reported that the deadline for artists to get their applications in to display their works at the 48th Annual Octagon Art Festival in Ames is June 30th. That festival will take place on September 23rd, and it's a big deal indeed. And there was word that Roosevelt Park on 9th Street here in Ames is going to have a pair of ping-pong tables, that's right, ping-pong tables, installed this summer. Players will have to bring their own paddles and balls to play. The tables are going to be on a concrete slab the city's going to pour on the park's north side next to the playground. Wednesday's Trib reported that a Boone firefighter had to go to the hospital Tuesday afternoon after he helped fight a house blaze. He was suffering effects from the heat. He was not identified. The fire caused at least $50,000 damage to a home at 127 South Story Street in Boone. From fire to water, Wednesday's Trib also reported that the city of Kelly still had some flooded streets nearly a week after those big thunderstorms rolled through the area last Thursday. The reason? A stormwater drain clog. The Trib also had word about Tuesday night's Ames City Council downtown visioning workshop, where several business representatives said they were concerned about the city's parking regulations and those regulations' negative effects. Most of the speakers asked the city to conduct a parking study on downtown, and the council unanimously instructed staff to bring back information on such a study, including word on how much it's going to cost. Some of the business people in attendance had signed a document objecting to what they called excessive ticketing downtown. One business owner said, in her words, "People are starting to get angry about it." She said the city should consider removing parking meters completely from downtown. There was also talk at the meeting about the possibility of building a parking structure downtown, but no action was taken. And one more note about all this, Ames' metered parking rates, they're going to go up July 1st. Wednesday's Trib also reported that Story County supervisors gave final approval on Tuesday to a RAGBRAI right-of-way ban. The supervisors decided to prohibit temporary vendors from selling merchandise in the immediate vicinity of county roads when the Register's annual Great Bike Ride Across Iowa rolls into the county on July 24th. Now, those restrictions will not apply to private properties in the city's unincorporated areas outside the right-of-way. In other action, the supervisors also approved the purchase of a new heat pump for the Story County Justice Center at a cost of $5,400 and heard that last week's torrential downpours caused some damage to the Environmental Learning Corridor in the Iowa State Research Park. There was more in Wednesday's Trib, including word that nominations and applications in the search for a new dean of Iowa State University's College of Veterinary Medicine are due by August 6th. Earlier this year, three finalists for the position were interviewed, but none of them got the job. And one more item of note from Wednesday's paper, a story about a Nevada couple who will be rolling around the streets of Nevada this summer in a tiny green three-wheeled pickup truck with polka dots on its body. A freezer is mounted on the back, and yes, it is an ice cream truck. Chad and Jennifer Anderson call it pint-sized ice cream, and if you live in Nevada, you'll likely see it on a street near you. Thursday's Tribune reported that a petition is circulating online calling for a closer look at the Ames School District's transportation provider, Durham School Services. That petition was created by a group called Stand Up for School Bus Safety out of Chattanooga, Tennessee. It's urging the school district to investigate Durham's safety record in Ames. The group was formed after six Tennessee children were killed in an accident 2 years ago while they were riding inside a Durham bus. The Ames District has contracted with Durham for student transportation for the past few years. There have been no fatal accidents here like the one in Chattanooga, though the district has reported some problems involving buses running late and some missed stops. But an Ames School District spokesman told the Tribune the district has no current safety concerns regarding Durham School Services. Thursday's Trib also reported that a planned $28 million expansion to Iowa State University's Jordan Business Building has taken another step forward. Weeks ago, an Iowa Board of Regents committee recommended approval of the project's design. Since then, three design teams have been selected as finalists out of 11 applicants for the expansion project. Construction of the 40,000-square-foot addition is set to begin next spring, but before that can happen, the full Board of Regents must give its approval. The board is scheduled to meet again in August. Also in Thursday's Trib, word that the library in the community of Collins remained closed after it was damaged last week by heavy rains and flooding. Water got into the library's main room. Lots of books and shelving had to be moved to other parts of the building so the wet floor could be dried out. There was also a story about the city of Zeering, which appears ready to buy the Story County Medical Center's building in town and then proceed with negotiations with the Hanson Family Hospital to get another clinic up and running. And one more note. On Thursdays, this one here in Ames, and this is an important one for drivers, 13th Street from the railroad tracks to Curtis Avenue going to be closed starting this coming Monday in Ames for utility, sidewalk, and pavement improvements. The closure is going to last between 6 and 8 weeks, depending, of course, on the weather. And then 13th from Curtis east to Harding will be closed, so if you use 13th Street, you're going to have to find a detour starting Monday. Today's Tribune, Fridays, reports that Governor Kim Reynolds has signed a disaster proclamation for Story County and eight other counties after our rains caused widespread flooding. That proclamation lets residents apply for state individual assistance grant program dollars, which can give affected households with incomes up to 200% of the federal poverty level, up to $5,000 to cover property repairs or replace clothing or food. Today's Trib also reports that two new administrators will join the Ames School District starting July 1st. Amy Lane will take over as the district's new Director of Curriculum and Instruction, and Brian Carrico will become Associate Principal at Ames High. And the Trib reports on two town hall meetings held yesterday here in Ames to give residents an overview of what to expect when the Register's annual Great Bike Ride across Iowa comes to town for an overnight stop. And again, that's on July 24th. Here's a hint of what we can expect. At least 10,000 bike riders and as many as 15,000 others are expected to show up. About 1,000 volunteers are needed to help handle all of this. So, Gail, I guess you and I are going to have to volunteer to help those bicyclists. And if we do, they'll only need 998 more volunteers. Can we do it?
No. I will say I'm going to try to leave town that weekend.
I guess they'll need 999 if I volunteer. I'm Dennis Hart. I'll be back here on Wednesday with news from some outlying papers. Good to be with you today.
Thanks for those updates, Dennis.
I am the fire that burns within your soul. I am the holy light that fills and makes you whole. I am the flame within that never dies. I am the sun that will ever arise. Sun, honor you this night, leap across the fire, keep all spirits bright, power of the sun, fire in the night, leap behind that which blinds to restore our sight. I am the fire that clears away the old. I am the holy light that guides you to your soul. I am the flame of love for which you yearn. I am the sun that will always return. Power of the sun, we honor you this night. Leap across the fire, keep our spirits bright. Power of the sun, fire in the night. Leave behind that which blinds to restore our sight. I am the fire that burns within your soul. I am the holy light that fills and makes you whole. I am the flame within that never dies. I am the sun that will ever arise. Power of the sun, honor you this night. Leap across the fire, keep our spirits bright. Power of the sun, fire in the night. Leave behind that which blinds to restore our sight. Clears away the old. I am the holy light that guides you to your soul. I am the flame of love for which you yearn. I am the sun that will always return. night. Leap across the fire, keep our spirits bright. Power of the sun, fire in the night. Leap behind that which blinds to restore our sight.
Yesterday was June 21st, the longest day of the year, and that was Lisa Thiel with the Summer Solstice song. The summer solstice, also known as midsummer, occurs when, in the case of the Northern Hemisphere, the Earth's North Pole is tilted at the greatest angle toward the sun. Of course, thousands of people gathered at Stonehenge for the summer solstice as the sun rose amid clear skies, it's reported. About 9,500 people were at the Neolithic monument to greet the start of the longest day of the year. The sun appeared behind the heel stone at 4:52 British Standard Time to cheering and applause from the crowd. The summer solstice is one of the rare occasions that English heritage opens up Stonehenge for public access. In Canada, June 21st is National Indigenous Peoples Day, a day recognizing and celebrating the cultures and contributions of the First Nations, Inuit, and Métis Indigenous peoples in Canada. Although it was the longest day of the year yesterday in Ames, it was rainy and cloudy, so we didn't get to see very much of the sun. I remember when I lived in Montana, one year on June 21st, we went hiking into the mountains to camp and celebrate the solstice. But we ended up camping in snow because the snow hadn't melted from high up in the mountains. But it was still a wonderful way to spend the longest day of the year, although it did not feel like summer. And while it's late June right now, there are loyal Cyclone football fans who are already looking ahead to fall and the start of football season.
Welcome to the 2018 Iowa State Football Preview. I'm your host, Colin Burzak, and it's never too early to start talking college football. Last season capped off one of the most historic seasons in Iowa State football history. Under the third season led by head coach Matt Campbell, the Cyclones managed to win 8 games. That's more wins than the last two seasons combined. Not only did the Cyclones beat the third-ranked Oklahoma Sooners led by Heisman Trophy winner Baker Mayfield.
This could be the play of the game. Mayfield looking. Plenty of time. Flushed. Over the middle. Incomplete.
Iowa State, the signature upset win from Matt Campbell and the staff.
What a signature win from Matt Campbell and Iowa State.
But they also beat fourth-ranked TCU right here in Ames.
Hill on second and 10.
And to cap it all off, the Clones beat the 20th-ranked Memphis Tigers in the Liberty Bowl. Mind you, the last time the Cyclones made a bowl game was in 2011, where they lost to the Rutgers in the Pinstripe Bowl, 27-13. The last time the Cyclones won a bowl game was back in 2009 against Minnesota. I was 16. However, things are looking up for football here in Ames, and there's no reason not to be optimistic. Yes, the Cyclones did lose some key pieces on the offensive and defensive side of the ball. Obviously, Joel Anning, Alan Lazard, and Kamari Cotton-Moya, just to name a few. But you have to look at the glasses being half full. It's huge having starting quarterback Kyle Kemp return for one last season. Kemp completed over 65% of his passes and threw for 13 touchdowns and only 3 interceptions. Pretty impressive numbers for a guy who just got tossed in midway through the season. It'll be pivotal having someone behind center who's familiar with the offense. Building off of that, wide receiver Hakeem Butler returns, looking to be Kemp's go-to guy. Butler hauled in 7 touchdown passes and finished with 41 receptions on the season. Standing at a whopping 6'6", he'll be an easy target in the end zone. Alongside Kemp and Butler, returns running back David Montgomery. After rushing for over 1,100 yards and 11 touchdowns, he was also on the Doak Walker Award watch list for the best running back in college football. And last but not least, Marcel Spears Jr. It was his first season playing at the linebacker position, and he made the most of it. He won Defensive Player of the Big 12 back-to-back weeks against Texas Tech and TCU, sealing the deal against Texas Tech with a late pick six and ruining TCU's season with the memorable interception to win the game at home. He averaged 8.5 tackles per game and won Defensive MVP in the Liberty Bowl, beating Memphis. In addition to the returning starters just mentioned, Iowa State has managed to recruit some very talented players from around the country. Most talked about is three-star recruit Brock Purdy from Gilbert, Arizona. Purdy played quarterback at Perry High School, where he broke Class 6A records. In just 14 games, Purdy threw for 4,400 yards and 57 touchdowns, catching the eyes of many colleges throughout the nation, including Florida, Boise State, Kansas, Central Florida, Texas A&M, and Alabama. Purdy released a statement on his reasoning for choosing Iowa State. "Iowa State came in early, and I got a relationship established with them early. Coach Campbell and his vision, Iowa State and the city of Ames, I want to be part of something like that. With close to 9,000 career passing yards and over 100 total touchdowns, the Cyclones will surely welcome Purdy to Ames with open arms." On a side note, related to recruiting Purdy, Purdy's top go-to receiver at Perry High, DeShane James, committed to Iowa State last winter. Purdy connected with James on 45 passes for over 1,000 receiving yards. If James does indeed stay committed to Iowa State, the chemistry between the two will surely play in the Cyclones' favor. The other top recruit of the Cyclones' 2018 class is receiver Joseph Skates from Dayton, Ohio. Skates has the ideal frame for a possession receiver. Standing at 6'3" and weighing 175 pounds, his physicality could cause problems against opposing defensive backs. During Skates' junior year of high school, he managed to rack up over 680 yards on 30 receptions. 14 of those receptions went for touchdowns. Skates seems like he'll serve as a versatile receiver that'll help the Cyclones through the air for years to come. On the contrary to all of this positivity leading into the 2018 season, there are a couple red flags. Iowa State plays four teams who are projected to be top 40 programs within the nation next season. Two or three of those teams will be played away from home. It's also very doubtful that Oklahoma will take their foot off their gas like they did last season when they come to Ames in September. And last but not least, although the Cyclones do return Hakeem Butler, they are still running thin at the wide receiver and defensive back position. There will be a lot of weight on the shoulders of inexperienced players this upcoming season. The front seven will have to put immense pressure on highly touted opposing quarterbacks, Kyler Murray and Will Greer. Some key games to look out for this upcoming season: September 8th, the Cyclones travel to Iowa City to play the Hawkeyes at 4 p.m. at Kinnick. On September 15th, they play the Sooners at home. September 29th, they go on the road to play Oklahoma State. October 6th, they play TCU on the road. And lastly, October 13th, they take on the Mountaineers in West Virginia. Before we wrap things up, I want to share what I think will be the toughest game of the season for the Cyclones and the easiest. Starting off with the toughest game, the road game against West Virginia. Will Grier is easily one of the most highly touted quarterbacks leading into this season with his top receivers returning back. Grier threw for 34 touchdowns and over 3,400 yards. Mind you, he would have thrown for more had he not broken his finger in late November, ending his season. Without Cotton Moya leading the Cyclones secondary, Grier and the Mountaineers will serve as anything more than a minor threat. Bringing us to the easiest game of the season, and this probably comes without saying, but just to fuel the rivalry, I'll say it anyways. The easiest game on the schedule without a shadow of a doubt will be on Saturday, November 3rd, when the Cyclones invade Lawrence, Kansas, to scrimmage the one-win Jayhawks. That's right. The Jayhawks only managed to win one game last year, and that's about how many people were in attendance as well for that game. Now I'll knock on wood for good measure, but this one should already be in the bag. I'm Colin Berzak, and in life only three things are certain: death, taxes, and football in the fall. Thanks for listening.
Thanks to Colin Berzak, a KHOI intern from the Greeley School of Journalism, for that football preview. It certainly gets us geared up for football season, which will be here sooner than we think. But now I've been joined in the studio by folks from the Ames Progressive Alliance. Carolyn Myers and Ann Kinzel are here. Welcome to both of you.
Well, thank you, Gail.
Thanks for being here. And you've brought with you Linda Hansen from Primary Healthcare.
Yes, good morning.
So I'm going to let you get us started with our discussion for the day.
Great. As Gail mentioned, we have Linda Hansen from Primary Healthcare here in Ames. For those of you who don't know, Primary Healthcare is a medical clinic in Ames that provides healthcare to underserved individuals. There are clinics located in Des Moines, Marshalltown, and Ames. And here in Ames, you provide family health care, pediatrics, obstetrics, gynecology, and behavioral health. Is that correct, Linda?
That's correct, yes.
Awesome.
So, Linda, it's really exciting to have you here. I spent the early part of my career working in healthcare and often serving underserved people. So it's totally exciting to see primary care, healthcare in Ames. Now, you're the director?
I'm the clinic director at the Ames office, yes.
And when did primary health care open in Ames?
We originally opened in Ames at a temporary location on Duff in January of 2014. And we opened in our current location in December of 14.
So where are you located in Ames?
We're currently located in West Ames off of Lincoln Way. 3510 Lincoln Way is our address.
Okay. Now, in Ames, primary health care must serve the same kind of population that it serves in other Iowa cities. Tell us a little bit about who you serve.
Well, our primary specialty area is people who have a lot of barriers to health care, underserved populations. So it would be a lot of people living in poverty, people who don't have access to insurance. We see a lot of patients with mental health problems. Homeless sector comes to our clinic. So it's those people that just really have difficulty accessing care elsewhere.
Now, we hear a lot about Medicaid in Iowa. Do you also serve patients who are enrolled in the Medicaid program?
We do. Almost half our patients, I think last time I looked, it was 46 or 47% of our patients have Medicaid. And we also have a position within our clinic, the health benefits specialist, that when you walk in, if you qualify for Medicaid, she'll help get patients on Medicaid so that their health care is covered.
So how would that work? Let's say I came into the clinic and I didn't know that I was eligible for Medicaid. Mm-hmm. How would I find that out?
So generally before your first appointment, we would have a conversation with you and tell you what documentation to bring in. However, if a patient comes in without that documentation, they can get on what's called presumptive Medicaid right away on that first visit based on their report of their income. And then that just has to be verified within, I think it's 60 days. That's not my expertise, but I think it's within 60 days that they have to verify their information in order to qualify for full Medicaid.
And you described to us a little bit about the patients that you serve. How many clinic visits are you seeing a year?
Per year? I can do per month.
Per month,
like about
okay,
800
fine.
People, 800 visits a month is what we're at about right now.
Okay, so we're talking about 96,000 clinic
or
patients
the math
a year.
Here. Yeah,
that's a lot. Mm-hmm. For a community the size of Ames. Now, do you serve people from around the county or primarily just from Ames?
Anybody in the county, and actually our services aren't limited to people in the county. We'll serve anybody from anywhere. We actually have patients coming from Jefferson, from Eagle Grove, from Belmont, from Fort Dodge. We don't turn anybody away. And we actually have a number of international student patients who are from a variety of countries. Particularly our OB provider, it's like a little international community. The way we provide OB care is really interesting. It's group prenatal care. It's called centering pregnancy. So our care is provided in a group. And as long as you speak English, you can be in the group. Otherwise, you have individual visits with an interpreter. But we'll have people from four or five different countries in a group. So it's really, really fascinating.
Interesting. So you mentioned an important point there. You provide translation services for patients?
We do. We have a number of members of our staff who speak Spanish. We have one member who speaks Arabic. And then if somebody speaks a language we don't have within the clinic for interpreter, we get a language line interpreter so that we're always having somebody that can speak their language.
Well, before I turn the questions over to mm-hmm. Carolyn, I have one more question that I want to ask you. When I worked in this area, one of the issues for low-income people who receive primary-type health care was that it was difficult to get them more specialized care if they need it. How does primary health care handle that?
Well, that continues to be a problem. We provide family practice level care. If somebody needs specialty care, if we can get them on insurance, we can send them to another provider. If they are uninsurable for whatever reason, we work with providers to try to get them on payment plans. We work with some hospitals and clinics in Des Moines that are not-for-profit clinics that can see people on financial assistance. We have a position in our clinic, our family support worker, whose job is to find services for people. There's also within Des Moines the volunteer provider network, where providers will actually voluntarily provide services for free. So that is a good chunk of time spent trying to find those specialty services.
So do you have referral patterns with our local practitioners at the McFarland Clinic or not?
Sure, yeah. Primarily for people on insurance, though. We receive funding as a not-for-profit for seeing people that don't have insurance. Mary Greeley also can see people that don't have insurance on their financial assistance. McFarland, because they're a for-profit clinic, understandably, they have to charge for their service, and so it's a little bit more difficult there. And so if they can't be seen at McFarland because they don't have insurance, we'll refer them to another provider.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So in what ways does, you know, the community of Story County and the city of Ames help support the clinic?
So there's a number of private organizations within the community that support us, mm-hmm. Churches that give us regular donations. And then we've applied for some grants within the community that have supported us. We had startup grants from United Way, Story County Foundation, lots and lots of individual donors. Mary Greeley was very instrumental in helping us get off the ground. And there's ongoing support from individuals within those groups as well.
Mm-hmm.
But most of our funding comes from either patient insurance or federal grants.
Okay.
So HRSA is our main funding source, and that's a federal funder.
Can you tell me what HRSA stands for?
Health Resource Security Authority.
Health Resources Services Administration.
Thank
I know
you.
This because
okay.
I once got a huge grant from them, so they're dear to my heart.
No, and I only ask that because a lot of people will not know necessarily what HRSA is. So we want to make sure that our listeners understand.
Absolutely.
Yes. So can you tell me more about some of the different groups that you work with in Story County besides McFarland Clinic and Mary Greeley?
Sure. So we have an arrangement with the homeless shelter, with ERP, Emergency Residence Project, and our family support worker goes there on Fridays and meets with clients and helps get them on insurance, help get them enrolled in entitlement programs like food stamps. And then he'll also see if they need a medical appointment and provide transportation to that appointment if needed. Such a large percentage of patients at the shelter have mental health needs, and so we try to get those needs met, because if we can stabilize their mental health, can help people move out of homelessness. We have an arrangement with Community and Family Resources to provide case management services for people who are addicted to opioids. Everybody's hearing about the opioid crisis, and we're addressing that in Story County through this arrangement where we have a provider that comes up and does provide Suboxone, which is the medication to help people who are struggling with addictions. And the best practice for that is to have counseling services along with it. So we work with various providers of counseling services in the community. We work strongly with MICA, Mid-Iowa Community Action. We're required as a community health center to provide dental services, and since there was already dental services in the community through MICA, we work with Story County Dental there to make sure that our patients get dental care. We work with YSS, we work with ChildServe, we work with I can't think of lots and lots of people.
Sure,
within
sure.
The,
that's a yeah. That's pretty awesome that you're able to work with so many different groups. It shows the importance of our community resources and working together. So yeah. I'm very excited to hear that. So speaking of the mental health services, I know that our state has struggled to provide enough, you know, access to mental health beds, and continues to struggle with finding service providers throughout the state. What particular challenges do you face at primary health care with providing mental health services?
Well, we experience those same challenges. A lot of our patients are living in poverty, and poverty is associated with mental health disorders. And so a large percentage of our patients do struggle with some mental health issue. And it has been difficult in the past and continues to be difficult to provide mental health services for our patients. We did make the decision to hire a mental health provider, Sally Kuhn, and she's with us 6 days a month. Her schedule tends to get booked out many, many weeks in advance.
Oh, yeah, I would imagine.
And we also are able to only provide mental health services to our patients. And so it continues to be a gap in care in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And we're trying to address for our patients, but it's still difficult because it's booked out so far.
Oh, definitely. So what are the main – do you mainly provide, you know, medication support at primary health care? Do you actually have counselors on staff?
So within our staff, we have a behavioral health consultant, mm-hmm. Austin, and he's a LISW, a social worker, and We use what's called an integrated approach to providing behavioral health services. So Austin doesn't have a schedule built on a daily basis with full of patients. He's just available in the clinic. And as a provider, a medical provider is seeing a patient for whatever their medical issue is, we ask a series of questions. We ask about depression, and we ask about anxiety, and we ask about domestic violence. We ask about chemical dependency or any other issue that the provider or the nurse feels maybe that they could benefit from having a social worker talk with them. We then do what's called a warm handoff. We'll say, you know what, I'm going to have you talk with Austin for a minute. Go get Austin, introduce him to the patient right there in that same visit. So it's not like, oh, we have to make a separate visit with a counselor.
Sure.
And he can provide short-term, brief intervention-type counseling, determine if the patient needs more intensive counseling or if they just need some brief intervention, and talk about how those issues might be affecting their overall health. He's available in the clinic during regular working hours and just to go in and see a patient as needed. And then we also have he also works very strongly with Sally, our med provider. So
sure.
She provides the medications. And with Dr. Bollinger, who's our pain and chemical dependency doctor that's working with the Suboxone program. So they all work very closely together to meet behavioral health needs.
Oh, that's great. So I'm sure that the privatization of Medicaid in the state has affected your clinic in good and bad ways. Can you tell me more about how that has changed things for you?
Well, I think the biggest issue with privatization has been just adapting to a new system, new requirements, the requirements for prior authorizations. It's taking more staff time to meet some of those requirements. We've had to add some extra staff in order to be able to follow the regulations that the MCOs, the private organizations, are requesting in order to get the services that our patients need.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's interesting about that is those are the same complaints you actually hear when private insurance became more MCO or HMO organized. Mm-hmm. So it's just reached the Medicaid level. Prior to Medicaid privatization, Medicaid was more of a fee-for-service kind of – so sort of now migrated to clinics like yours.
Correct.
So speaking about Medicaid privatization – that's also – the other side of that is before Iowa privatized Medicaid, it also expanded access to Medicaid to working adults who did not have children in the home or weren't disabled. So you saw an influx, I assume, of patients after that?
With the Affordable Care Act,
yeah,
definitely. It was just before I started when we opened the clinic. And what I was told at that time was that we were about between 45% and 50% uninsured and about 20% Medicaid, and that just flipped. So with the Affordable Care Act, now we're about 45% Medicaid and 20% uninsured.
So
it just got a lot more people on insurance.
Sure. Yeah. So that must have helped primary health care.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. We have and helped our patients be able to access the specialty care we were talking about. Helped us be financially solvent. So definitely a change.
All right. Well, that's interesting because I think it's something in the story that has been kind of lost. When I practiced healthcare law, if you were an adult who you either had never had children or your children were out of the home, no matter how poor you were not eligible for Medicaid. And that's just such an amazing change to see. And I can only hope that that continues in our country because without that, we would return to a time where so many working adults and low-income adults would be without access to any health care except on a sort of beg-and-borrow basis. So it's good to hear that that's impacted you as a clinic and impacted the people that you serve.
Definitely a huge impact on accessing services.
Now, tell me a little. You said earlier that you provide family practice care level services. And some people in our listening audience may have only an internal medicine primary care provider.
Correct.
So tell me what that means. You serve children?
We see children. We see adults for basic primary care. We also do have. So internal medicine would see typically older adults or patients that have more complex medical histories. And we do have an internal medicine clinic in Des Moines that we can refer to if the needs are a little bit more complex. But in the Ames Clinic, we do primary care. And then we have a pediatrician that comes a couple days a month. We have Sally that does behavioral health medication management. And then we have a midwife that does our women's health and OB care. Did I forget anybody? I don't think so. I think that's it.
So when you deliver care at the clinic, how many employees are there?
Currently we have in the Ames Clinic about 25.
And how many of those are directly related to caring for patients?
All of us in some way.
let me rephrase that. let me say, how many of them actually provide hands-on medical care to patients?
Probably about 12 to 15 of those people are providers, medical providers, behavioral health providers, nurses, and then family support worker who would work directly with patients. I don't know, like when you get into the insurance side.
Sure. No, that's okay. Do you use PAs for physician's assistants,
We
for
do.
Example?
We use nurse practitioners and physician's assistants predominantly. We have one brand new provider who started this week, Dr. McCurdy, and she's a DO, and she's our only doctor-level provider at this point. Well, will be as soon as Dr. Sadala is leaving and moving to North Carolina at the end of next week. So she will be our new medical provider. And then the rest of them are, of our providers, medical providers, are nurse practitioners or physician's assistants.
That's right. You mentioned DOs. When I came to Iowa, I was amazed at how many DOs there were who were doing medicine. Because in many states, doctors of osteopathic medicine are not recognized as licensed medical providers. But Iowa has a school of osteopathic medicine.
Correct, in Des Moines.
In Des Moines, yeah.
Yes.
And so you use the DOs. They often do family practice type work.
Correct.
Now, is this a brand new physician?
Yes, new this week.
Oh, boy.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow.
And I know it's only been a week, but I'm pretty impressed with her.
Well, that's great.
She's doing a really good job.
I think our time is up.
I had one question.
Yes,
if I
of
may.
Course. Absolutely.
You mentioned asking people to bring documentation so you can see their income level and so on. But people don't have to bring citizenship proof.
No,
or
absolutely
how does
not.
That work?
No, we don't ask for a Social Security number. We don't ask for any kind of proof of citizenship. We want to be a safe place for whoever needs care. The assumption is that some of our patients are undocumented, but we don't ask that question, so we don't have any statistics on it. But we are a safe place for people to come and get care.
Okay. Well, that's really important.
Know. Yeah.
That's kind of an open area of the law. Some you can ask. It's not illegal to ask that question, but there's a number of border states, and in California, that lawsuits have been brought over the years, and medical providers are barred or enjoined from asking that question if they're providing federally or state-provided services. And it is important. When you do ask the question, in my experience, you do lose people.
Yeah, so yes. That's important that people know that they're not going to be asked that question if they come to
Correct.
To your
And it's the same thing with substance abuse. You're going to have people who come in with substance disorders, And it's a safe place for them to come as well.
Absolutely. We take confidentiality very, very seriously. And that is has a higher standard when you're talking about behavioral health disorders and addiction disorders, that the standard is very, very high for confidentiality. And even sharing records is more difficult because we want people to feel like it's a safe place.
Absolutely. So okay. I have to ask one more question. What's your background and what got you into this work?
I've been in the medical profession for many years. I was a physical therapist, and I guess I still am a physical therapist. In 2000, I went to seminary, and I'm also ordained clergy. And my first call to ministry with my family was to be a missionary in Honduras. And so we lived in Honduras for 5 years, and I saw pretty intense poverty there, the effects of intense poverty. We did health care. My spouse is a nurse, and so we did health care mission work there. And then I came back and tried pastoring a church, and it was a good experience, but it wasn't kind of where I fit. I really fit with serving those people who are really have a lot of barriers to health care. And so when this position came open, I was like, oh, my gosh, it's 3 blocks from my house. I can practice my Spanish. It's health care. It's working with underserved. This is my job. And it has been ever since.
So. I knew there was a story behind this because people who get in this line of work, this is a passion for them.
Definitely.
So I knew that Linda would have a story for
us.
Yes,
definitely. Well, Linda, I'd like to thank you very much for all that you do for the community. And you know, primary healthcare has a huge, immense impact, and we're so grateful that primary healthcare is here and that you are leading us with that effort. So thank you very much.
Thank you for having
me. Yes. Be sure to keep up with all APA activities on the Ames Progressive Alliance Facebook page and our website, amesprogressivealliance.org. You can get a copy of this radio show and follow the latest developments for the Ames Community Solar Initiative and for Ames Progressive Alliance through KHOI. Thanks to KHOI for hosting the show. Thanks for doing so much for our community, KHOI, and also working towards a progressive future.
Thank you all for being here. That was Ann Kinzel, Carolyn Myers, and Linda Hansen. And this is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Gail Seiler. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered by Jackie Norman. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. If you value the stories and interviews we bring you on Local Talk, why not show your support by becoming a member of KHOI? You can do it online. Just go to the website, khoifm.org, and look for the donate button. Or you can call 515-292-2878. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as audience and supporter is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. The Ames Main Street Farmers Market brings local food and fun every Saturday, located between the 300 and 400 blocks of Main Street, including Tom Evans Plaza. The Farmers Market brings fresh local fruits, veggies, meats, breads, handcrafted goods, live music, and family entertainment.